the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 1070 The Fan. Thanks for joining us for the Tuesday night edition of the Race Week program as we get set for the 101st Indianapolis 500. My name is Kevin Lee, the historian of this great race and this great place. Donald Davidson is with us, and it's a special show tonight. Maybe you can hear in the background, well, we've assembled the Field of 33 to provide some ambient noise for us here this evening. So it was nice of them to open up the track at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night when they normally would not do so. Or possibly we taped it Monday afternoon during that final long full practice. So what that means is Donald is doing something tonight. He's actually doing it at the IMS Museum with Scott Goodyear and Al Unser Jr. Hopefully, maybe you're listening on the podcast and you've actually gone to that event tonight. Otherwise, we will entertain you live here on the radio or the podcast. It's available at Trackside Podcast on iTunes and at 1070thefan.com. So what that also means is no phone calls tonight. Hang on to those. Donald is back tomorrow night for live phone calls at 8 o'clock, and no need to send your emails. I have, probably close to 100 or so. So we'll get to as many as we can, and we've already collected all of those. So let's get into it, Donald, and okay. See what we have from people tonight that have submitted here in the last month or so. Clay in Sydney, Australia. Good morning, whoa, Clay. He'd like to hear about Sir Jack Brabham and his first time at the Speedway as a driver and car manufacturer team owner as well.
Okay, well, that was the Cooper Car Company from Surbiton on south of London. And Jack Brabham was actually the defending two-time world champion when he came to Indianapolis in 61. His first visit had been the previous October, and that had been in the works for almost a year. And the beginnings of it was the first Grand Prix of the United States that was held at Sebring in Florida. I know a lot of people think, oh, no, that was the Sebring 12 Hours. Same course, but the first U.S. Grand Prix was held, I think, like December the 1st or December the 2nd or something like that of 1959 at the same course down in Sebring. So Roger Ward, and a lot of people made fun of this, Roger Ward had great success in Formula Libre races driving USAC midgets on a road course. And he actually famously won a race at Lime Rock Kenny Brand was the owner of that one. Well, Bob Wilkie of Leader Cards, that owned the car that Ward had driven to victory in 1959, had a midget, which Roger drove occasionally. And so they said, we've done well on some road courses in what they call Formula Libre races. Let's take this down to Sebring and run it in the U.S. Grand Prix. Well, within moments of the first practice session, they realized that they were clearly outclassed. And Roger started at the back and ran, I don't know, maybe a third of the race and dropped out. So a lot of people made fun of that. And that was a shame because Roger, some of the drivers were, I wouldn't say tunnel vision, but they were focused on what they did. Mm-hmm. And Roger had much broader horizons, and he'd already run in some sports car races. It wasn't just midgets on road courses. He'd also driven in sports car races with sports cars. So anyway, when they realized very quickly that they were outclassed, but Roger was very impressed by the handling characteristics of the Coopers and rear engine cars just had their reintroduction into Grand Prix racing. Most of the cars were still front engined, but Cooper had done very well that year, and Jack Brabham was on his way to winning the world championship. So Ward went over there to talk with them. And unlike some of the other teams, which tended to be perhaps defensive and not big on sharing information, John Cooper, who's not to be mistaken with the John Cooper that became president of the Speedway, John Cooper, who was the son of the founder of the Cooper Car Company, and incidentally, that's the company that started the Mini Coopers. So we're all kinds of ties in. But anyway, John Cooper was a very outgoing, fun-loving guy who went motor racing for fun, And so he was very interested in what Roger had to say. And he said, you know, your car can't handle it. He said, it handles so well. Have you thought about ever going to Indianapolis? Because I think your car, your rear engine car, would do very well there. They're all front engine cars at the moment. And so Jack Brabham, I don't know really what his point of interest was. I think it was probably just as much John Cooper as it was Brabham, except that Jack Brabham in Australia had run what they called speed cars. Well, we call them midgets, but down under they're called speed cars. And Jack Brabham had raced those, so he knew what it was like to run on cinder tracks and shale tracks and so on and so forth. And so, anyway, almost a year later, that was December 59, in October of 1960, there was a Formula Libre race at Watkins Glen, New York. And the U.S. Grand Prix still wasn't there. There was one in 1960, but that was at Riverside. So they had this Formula Libre race. And after the race was over, and it was probably late October, I would think, of 1960, they came down here. Brabham and Cooper came to Indianapolis, and they had a private test, which apparently was set up by Roger Ward. In fact, one of his sons told me that Jack Brabham actually stayed at Roger's house while they were here for a couple of days. So it was a Grand Prix car. And they ran laps, and I think whatever speed Brabham got up to, I think it was like 140. It was up in the 140 mile an hour range, but it was up right that it would have qualified him in the most recent 500. So they went back and prepared to build a car for Indianapolis. It was a Formula One Grand Prix Cooper, basically. But it was beefed up somewhat because the bricks on the main straightaway still 714 yards of bricks, and then they tilted the engine slightly over to one side because they'd seen they had a look at some roadsters while they were here, which were built specially for all left-hand turns. So they came back in 61. And there was a lot of interest in the thing, and Brabham had just won the world championship for a second time, so now he was the two, you know, he'd won the two most recent world championships, and he got up to speed and went through the rookie test and everything. Although he thought, well, I'm the world champion, why can't I just go out and practice? But they said, well, this is more of a familiarization test to bring you up to the speed gradually. And some of the Europeans thought that was a good thing, and others were kind of scoffed at it a little bit. But anyway, then it came to the point where Jack Brabham was still committed to a Grand Prix schedule. And on the first qualifying weekend, Saturday and Sunday, there was a Grand Prix on Sunday, and I think it was Monaco, but I'm not positive, and obviously in the middle of the week. But one way or another, Brabham had to qualify on Saturday and then leave as soon as he could to fly back to Europe and run in what I think it was the Monaco Grand Prix. So he got it done. And in fact, actually, he might even have been the first one out. And he ran the three warm-ups, and the green didn't come out. So he was brought back in. And then in those days, the drivers signaled to their readiness to begin the qualifying attempt by raising their hand. Well, apparently Jack had done that, but in the little rear engine Cooper lying on his back practically, they hadn't seen the hand. So he was given the benefit of the doubt, and whoever was next up, they put Brabham back to the head of the line, and out he went, did the four laps, 145 something. And 144 something, I don't remember what the decimals were. And then I think it ended up that he started 15th, I think. And then immediately left to do the Grand Prix and then came back to get ready for the race. And it finished a very respectable ninth. And up to that time, a lot of people think that, you know, that was the first rear-engine car. Well, it wasn't. Rear-engine cars were entered regularly between 1937 and 1951. Only four ever qualified, and all of them had dropped out. So the furthest that a rear engine car had ever traveled was 47 laps in 1939. And Brabham went the full 500 miles, and Foyt won the race. And in those days, they would let as many cars as reasonable complete the distance. And so Brabham would have been a handful of laps down, and then completed the 200 eventually, and earned membership into the Champion 100-mile-an-hour club. So when you look at the box score, some people say, well, golly, he was in the lead lap. Well, if you look at the elapsed times, and I don't remember what they were now, but hypothetically, it might have been 7 or 8 minutes after Foyt had won the race. But that was considered, that for a lot of people, the handwriting was on the wall. Mm-hmm. And the lightweight rear engine car, the engine size, and I'm almost done here, the cubic inch displacement was quite a bit under what was allowable. And I'm thinking that you were allowed 4.2 liters at that time. And I think he was like 2.7. So it could have been quite a bit larger. But what he gave up on the straightaways in speed, he made up with superior handling qualities. And so that got a lot of people's attention. And so anyway, you could say that Jack Brabham started not the rear engine revolution, but the second wave of the rear engine revolution. And it wasn't long before all of the cars were rear engine.
And he also started a bit of the Formula One revolution of Formula One drivers coming over to
yes.
Indianapolis.
Well,
there had been others
there
before,
had been
but
others,
we saw
but
quite a few in the 60s. Yeah. And that reminds me, I just counted again. We've got five that have raced in a Formula One event that are in this year's 500. Do we go back to... Now, I'm sure there were some in the 70s where we had more than five.
Yeah.
They weren't current, but they had done it before.
That's very much of a gray area because of the fact that the Formula One is so different now that you have to declare at the beginning of the year. Each team only runs two cars, and then your drivers, it's pretty rare for there to be a driver change.
You could do
one-offs. But back in then,
yeah.
there used to be a lot of one-offs.
Like David Hobbs did just a few
He did quite a few, but I mean, Sam Posey
yep.
drove in the Grand Prix of the United States in 71 and 72.
Roger Penske,
yeah, but of course he never drove in the 500. But yes, he did. He had two Grand Prix starts, but Bobby Rahal had actually run Formula One Grand Prix. He ran the Canadian and the U.S. Grand Prix. Before he ever came to Indianapolis. So
yeah.
that's a little sketchy. But in recent years, though, five is probably more than in recent years. But if you go back just a little further, there were a lot of them that could say, I have driven in a Grand Prix.
Clay, thank you for your question tonight. We'll get to more email questions that we've already received for Donald Davidson. We are at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, plausibly live this evening. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Thank you for staying with us on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Tonight we are only taking email questions that we have previously received. And you may hear some ambient noise in the background from our taping session on Monday afternoon at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I'm sending an email to people that we are using their question, so you'll know in advance. So to make sure everyone gets an opportunity to hear their question that might have been submitted 3 or 4 weeks ago. This question is from Don. He says, in memory of Donald Catton, the question is, can you profile the Orange Vita Fresh Orange Juice Special and Gordon Van Loo?
Oh, yeah, Vita Fresh Orange Juice Specials. Yeah, Gordon Van Loo was the president of that and maybe the owner of the company. I'm not too sure about that. But he lived in Houston, and it's funny how some of these things are carved in granite in your brain. His address was 1 Shatter Way, Houston. And that's been a while. I don't know why that just sticks with me, but that one does. His first car actually was a car that was already entered in 1962 that he took over during the month of May, and a couple of drivers tried to get it up to speed, but it didn't make an attempt. But in 1963, he came back with a Roadster that appeared to be a Watson, but it was actually built by, and this was it Dave Schneider, I think, and that might not be right. So anyway, I know it was a one-off. There were several cars. Watson had several cars that were built in his shop in California, but there were several others that were either built by Watson friends or some people just did their own interpretation of what the Roadster would be like. Dave Schneider was the chief mechanic. I'm not sure that he was the builder now, but anyway, the Vita Fresh Orange Juice special, and it started out with Bruce Jacoby, and Jacoby spun during practice, and I don't remember whether he came back and drove it some more, but at some point a driver change was made, and Dempsey Wilson, I love to say that name, Dempsey Wilson qualified and was the 33rd fastest qualifier. So he didn't start 33rd, but I think that, and he may not, well, got to think about that. I know that he came close to, he rode the bubble in several different years. Anyway, he did run all day and finished 11th and was quite a number of minutes, as we said in an earlier answer, from the time Parnelli Jones won to the time that Dempsey Wilson completed his 200 laps to finish 11th was probably about 12, 13 minutes. Anyway, the next year, there was a new rear engine car built by Troutman and Barnes, which turned out to be not very successful. No, wait a minute. Don Edmonds. Don Edmonds built the rear engine car for Vita Fresh, and they had the Roadster, and the driver was going to be Roger McCluskey, and Roger was injured in a sprint car in April, or was it late March, early April? He was involved in a sprint car accident and was injured and had to miss several weeks, which included the entire month of May. So Judd Larson was in the mix for a little bit, and Dempsey Wilson tried to qualify the rear engine car, and I actually witnessed that qualifying attempt where he did a couple of laps and then spun through turn one and hit the wall, and so that obviously was an incomplete attempt. In the meantime, the Roadster had been turned over to Johnny Boyd, who qualified it and had his second best finish, which was fifth. And then in 1965, Chuck Stevenson qualified the Roadster and did not finish, and he was one of the last four. It was one of the last four of the front engine cars powered by a normally aspirated Offenhauser engine. There was an Offie-powered Roadster the next year with Bobby Grimm, but that was turbocharged. But in 65, the last four people to drive a 4.5-liter, 255 cubic inch, four-cylinder Offenhauser engines, non-turbocharged, non-supercharged, were Gordon Johncock, Eddie Johnson, Ernie Knepper, and Chuck Stevenson. In 66, there were two rear engine cars, and Bobby Unser was on board by this time. In fact, in 1965, Bobby Unser drove a four-wheel drive Novi at Indianapolis, which was out in the second lap accident, but the Novis didn't run the rest of the races, so I think Bobby ran the rest of the year for Vita Fresh, if not then most of the races. And then in 65, 65, Joe Leonard drove some Vita Fresh cars in dirt track races. So let's back to 66 at the Speedway, and we don't have very much further to go. Bobby Unser was able to qualify. Chuck Stevenson was not. These were rear-engine cars now. And I think Bobby Unser in 66 had one of the first of the turbo offies. The attrition rate was considerable, but he was kept it in for the full run and ended up finishing in eighth place. And then in 67, it was Larry Dixon for Vitafresh, and he finished fifth. And I think, 67, I think was the last year for the Vitafresh Orange Juice Specials. But love that sponsorship, love that name. And I actually was a guest in Gordon Van Loo's house in January of 1966, which was quite a night. I'd gone down there, and I'll wind this one up. I'd gone down there actually to I was one of the speakers, or I had a presence, if you like, at a banquet to honor A.J. Foyt, and it ended up being to honor other Texans in racing. And this could be rather a long story, and I know Dave from Marion likes this one, but the short version is that I went to Eb Rose's house, and that's where I met Gus Grissom and Gordon Cooper. And then we went from there to Gordon Van Loo's house. And Judd Larson, Roger McCluskey. Anyway, it was quite a night. Bobby Unser.
Wow.
All right. Anyway, that's Vitafresh Orange Juice Specials.
Don, thank you for the question. Next is Mark. He is the host and executive producer of Whiskey Cast, which always catches my attention on his email signature. And Mark's a regular listener to this show and to Trackside as well. He asks, what are the qualifications to become a member of the Old Timers Club, and would any of the senior drivers in the field be eligible to be members yet, specifically Elio and Tony Kanaan?
Oh, yeah. The rules have changed over the years. When it was first formed in 1961, in the beginning, it was strictly for drivers who had driven in the 500.
Okay.
You had to be a driver with a 500 career.
And you were eligible after your first appearance?
No. It said that you had to have been involved 20 years ago or more.
Ah, gotcha.
And they relaxed that fairly early, because I remember they took Dwayne Carter, and he'd only been around 17 years. But anyway, it was to change greatly after that. But in the beginning, it was drivers in the 500 only. And then chief mechanics in the 500 only. You could not, crew members had to be exceptional, had to have made an exceptional contribution. So it was drivers, car owners, and chief mechanics. And even the safety patrol, I think it was just the heads of department. The rank and file weren't eligible. But over a period of years, that changed quite a bit. I remember that I thought they were a little strict, because Leroy Warner, who had tried to qualify several times and hadn't, applied for membership, and he was denied because he hadn't driven in the race. And then over a few years later, things relaxed, and then he was eligible. So, yes, any of the drivers now, in fact, they make whenever you win the 500, they make you an honorary member. So Alexander Rossi is actually an honorary member of the Old Timers Club. And as we speak, has only driven in one race last year.
And as far as the way it is currently, I'd always heard the standard is if you have just been out here 20 years. Obviously, the requirements have relaxed quite a bit.
The requirements have relaxed quite a bit, yes.
Yeah. So I think I'm eligible at this point, but
I'm
going to withhold. As you get older, you don't want to be referred to as old quite so much. I'm trying to hold off.
No, I remember Sid Collins. He didn't like, he said, old timers. He said, I don't want to join because it sounds like you're sitting in a rocking chair with a corn cob pipe. He said, why don't they call it like Speedway Veterans or something like that? So, but nope, still the Old Timers Club.
All right, more to come with Donald in just a moment. Stay with us. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5, 1070 The Fan. Race week, Sunday, the 101st Indianapolis 500. Live calls again tomorrow night, tonight and Thursday night. Our email shows from questions that we received leading in until Monday. So we've been collecting them for the last month or so. But tomorrow night you'll have a chance once again for live telephone questions for Donald. And next up is a question from No Name. Okay. Profile George Bignotti and his years at IMS. And Mary just left. Mary Mendez, his daughter, was right behind us.
So no, that's okay.
Maybe we should come back to that one. Now, go ahead. I believe Mary's fairly familiar with George's career.
All right. Well, George's career at the most successful chief mechanic, certainly in terms of victories, because he was the chief mechanic on 7. And his tenure at the Speedway as a chief mechanic, well, his first year at the track was 1954. He was not a chief mechanic until 56. And he went all the way up until 84, I think. Anyway, I have to stop and think about that one a little bit. But I could certainly do the early days. He was very successful in BCRA, Bay Cities Racing Association Midgets in Northern California, and won the championship with Fred Agabation, I think, 3 times, and then also with Johnny Boyd, and then but he was a florist. And so he'd never come to Indianapolis, and Fred Agabation, of course, started in 1947. And over the years, he would say to George, "You really got to come back to Indianapolis." And George says, "Well, you know, I'm a florist now and run midgets on the weekend. But," he said, "if ever you get in a jam, I'll come back. So just give me a call." So he said in 1954, he said, one day in May, George told me this story. He said, "I'm standing on a ladder in the florist shop doing something. And the phone rang. And it was Fred Agabation. Said, 'Help, I need you.'" So George came back. I think he was going to be chief mechanic. And Fred Agabation was driving the MERS Engineering Special for Miklos Sperling. By the time he got back, Frankie Delroy had already been hired as the chief mechanic. But George came on, and I think he was the engine man and served in that role under Frankie Delroy in 54 and 55. And Agabation was 6th in 54. In 55, Walt Faulkner was 5th with Bill Homer as a relief driver. And then during the before the next year, a corporation was signed. George Bignotti got together, how this came about, I don't know, with Bob Bowes II, who was the son of one of the two brothers who had sponsored the Bowes Seal Fast Specials in the 30s and 40s. And so they formed a team, entered a car, and Johnny Boyd was the driver. And there's several stories there, but just to kind of move the thing along, Johnny Boyd qualified for the race, but was out. I think he had an oil leak fairly early. He finished 30th. In 57, they had 2 cars, and Fred Agabation qualified 4th and went into the first turn 2nd and ran 2nd for a while, eventually to drop out. Finished 22nd, but Boyd went on to finish 6th. In 58, it was Boyd and Bob Veith. Veith qualified for the inside. I think they qualified next to each other. I think Boyd did not start 5th. Never mind. Anyway, Veith started 4th and got tangled up in the big accident up in turn 3, which took the life of Pat O'Connor. Vice car was severely damaged in that, and he was able to bring it around into the pits, but was out of the race with just 1 lap to his credit. And a lot of people, several people have suggested to me that Vice looked like a potential winner that year, and that may have been his best shot. Anyway, 59, it was Johnny Boyd was 6th, and Judd Larson was involved in an accident at lap 47. 58, it was Boyd and A.J. Foyt. And they neither one of them finished, but Foyt went on to win the national championship that year. with Bignotti as the mechanic, and then they come back as the defending national champions, driver and chief mechanic and owners in 61, and won the 500. This is the short version. late race duel with Eddie Sachs, back and forth a couple of times, but Foyt won the race, and then went on to defend the national championship. In 62, he dropped out of the 500, had a wheel come off after a pit stop, but he wasn't having the greatest day anyway. Went to Milwaukee, and then he and Bignotti were very similar in personalities in a lot of ways. Anyway, they came to a parting of the ways. What a shame. They did get back together again, but so for the summer, Bobby Marshman, Bignotti Bose dissolved. The cars were sold to Bill Anstead and Shirley Murphy. Bignotti went with the deal. Bobby Marshman was the driver. And then Foyt, in the meantime, had gone to Lindsay Hopkins. And there was a really neat round, musical chairs thing involving about six or seven drivers. And then George told me, he said, after Trenton and prior to two more races to go in the 63 season, Sacramento and Phoenix, and he says Bill Anstead calls up all excited and said, George, we made a deal with Lindsay. He's going to take Bobby Marshman and we get Foyt. And George thinks, oh no. Well, anyway, they're back together again. And they won, they won Sacramento. They won Phoenix now. I think Roger Ward won Phoenix, I think. Anyway, so then the next year, they had a tremendous year. There were 13 races, and they won 10. And actually, there's a little bit more to it than that, but I better hurry the thing along. In 65, they didn't get off to the greatest start. Foyt won the pole. And shortly after Indianapolis, they split again. And so then George became part of a new team with John Meekham, and they ran a handful of races in the second half and late 1965 with Roger Ward, but didn't have a decent finish, but a couple of good runs. And then they come back in 66 with a really bolstered-up team and ended up winning the race with Graham Hill. Jackie Stewart dropped out late leading. Roger Ward dropped out earlier, but we talked about that a few days ago. And then I probably should really move the thing along now. We'll jump to 1970, where George wins with Al Unser and the Vel Sponelli-Jones team. They, in fact, back-to-back in 70 and 71 with Al. And then at the end of the 72 season, George left. He went to Patrick Racing Team and got a victory in the rain shortened the one that we want to try and forget, 1973. And then we'll just jump to the, I think that accounts. So we've got Foyt in 61 and 64, Graham Hill in 66, Al in 67, I'm sorry, Al in 70 and 71, John Cock in 73, and then Tom Sneaver in 1983. So there's a lot of George stories to tell. And that's probably putting it into a nutshell. I don't remember how many championship victories that he had. I'm stuck on that number, but it was a lot. And I think to this day, he's still considered the winningest chief mechanic ever.
His longstanding, I cheat.
Okay.
I cheat. I just did a quick Google search. 85.
85, okay.
Jim McGee ultimately surpassed Bignotti's longstanding record of 85 IndyCar race wins as a crew chief.
Yeah. The role had changed, honestly. Because by the time Jimmy McGee was a lot of those victories where he was effectively the team manager and not a hands-on guy.
Yeah.
And not to take nothing away from him, but things had changed. When George, the early victories were the chief mechanic was pretty much everything. And his first victory was 1958 with Jed Larson at Phoenix, I believe was the first one. And in those days, the chief mechanic was sort of the engine man and everything.
Yep. Well, George's daughter, Mary, is back, but she's still not listening. She has headphones on, so we just profiled your dad, Mary. No, you weren't listening. All right, more to come with Donald Davidson. Stay with us. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Our email-only edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley continues on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee. With the star of the show, Donald Davidson. You may hear race cars in the background. They've been kind enough to assemble for us for the taping of this particular program. And back to our email questions, and this one comes from Blaine. He says, I'm really interested in drivers who, for one reason or another, made only one 500 start. Could you please ask Donald to profile Dusty Farno, and then I may ask you, just who are the most notable that were just here one time, and that's the only time.
Okay, well, it wouldn't be Dusty Farno.
I'm not familiar with his work.
He was around for a few years, but just had the one start with the Superior Trailer Special, and then he also actually. I wasn't expecting that one because I collect my thoughts on that one a little bit. Last year, there were 763 drivers who were driven in the Indianapolis 500, and as of next Sunday, it will be 767 different drivers. But of those, there's probably more than 250 with one start.
Wow.
And some great success, and others, there's a couple that had one start and finished last, or, you know, already did a couple of laps. But Dusty Farno was from Ohio, lived here for a short time, and I'm stuck on the town now. It wasn't Springfield, Ohio, but it was Sydney. I think it might have been Sydney, Ohio. I don't think I've ever been asked about it. His name was Herbert. Went by Dusty. Anyway, in 1932, he drove relief laps in the car that finished 10th with Joe Huff, the Highway Truck Part Special. And that was a business from Indianapolis that was on the very near east side, I mean, practically downtown, about when you're going east on Washington. And then the road goes southeastern, starts and goes at an angle. There's I think a Hardee's there or something like that. That's where the Goldberg Brothers Highway Truck Parts business was. Anyway, that car finished 10th, and Dusty Farno, I believe, probably relieved for a while and then got out so that Joe Huff could finish. And then he drove in 1934. Had to start with the Superior Trailer Special. And then I think he was around in 35 and 36 and didn't make it. So he was a dirt track driver, and that's probably about the extent. I know that some people had asked me over the years, when did he pass away? And I don't think I ever determined when he passed away. I know there's websites now where people have done some pretty good work on. You're going to look it up. You can't take them all to the bank because I know that there's a couple of times where they've had somebody that supposedly passed away, and the person was still alive, and they had found somebody of the same name and put two and two together and got the wrong answer. So if you're going to look it up,
There's not really much showing for Dusty Farno. Okay. So most significant. One-time starters.
Yeah.
Obviously,
sure.
The first winner was a one-time starter.
Ray Haroon just had the one start, but there's a lot of other people that had one start, and normally it was because of injury that would make a short career. But Howdy Wilcox II from Indianapolis, who was not related to the 1919 winner, had the one start and finished second. And then there was Arthur Duret. Who was in 1914, he was second. And then he was a Belgian national born to French parents in New York. So where was he from? I mean, that question came up in just with this year's starting field about where the drivers are from. Well, it depends on how you look at it. Anyway, he finished second in his only start. In fact, his only appearance here as a driver. And then George Amick was second in 1958 and then lost his life before another 500 could be run. And then Johnny White was fourth in 1964. Al Holbert was fourth in his only start in 1984. And then, Mickey Rupp, I'll pick that one out of the air, just the one start in 1965 and finished sixth. And that's a really good question. I'm sure there's some other people I could go back and pick up that had really a spectacular career of one start. For a while, Juan Pablo Montoya. Well, mm-hmm. Everybody who ever drove in the 500 had only had one start at some point in their career. So this is a little silly.
His lasted almost 15 years.
It did, and I never thought that he would come back. That one was a surprise, but. Anyway, I think the runners up who appeared only once, I think, are Arthur Duray, George Amick, and Howdy Wilcox II. I think those are Christian Fittipaldi. Christian Fittipaldi, Emo's nephew, had the one start in 1995 and finished second
right
and
the
never
split.
Came back again.
And that was because of the split. And by
the time
he had moved on to sports car racing by the time that they, and is still driving today, by the time they came back together. Good question. Let's see if we can sneak this one in. This is from Ed. One of the forgotten race cars of the early 20th century was a closed cockpit car nicknamed the Golden Submarine, designed after the death of Bob Berman. Is that right?
Bob Berman.
He has a different name there, by Harry Miller and driven by Barney Oldfield.
Yes.
I've seen numerous articles say it qualified in 19 but dropped out due to engine trouble. My question is, did that actually happen? I can find no evidence, but if true, it would be the only closed cockpit car ever in the 500 or IndyCar.
Okay, it wasn't closed cockpit when it came to the 500. That car actually mostly was Barney Oldfield was a barnstormer. And the car supposedly did run in the 1919 500, but without the enclosed body. So it just looks more like a regular race car. Roscoe Soros, who was born in New Albany and lived the latter part of his short life in Lafayette, went to Lafayette Jeff, drove that car in 1919, and I think it was out after eight laps or so. And then it was entered in 1920 with Waldo Stein. I don't know that the car ever arrived, but once again, it looked like all of the other cars. It wasn't enclosed with the windows as you see it.
Gotcha.
When Barney Oldfield was barnstorming,
and he was still barnstorming that late. How long?
Oh, yeah, Barney
because,
Oldfield.
Because he was one of the guys in 1908, 1909, 1910.
Yes, I mean he was a legitimate driver, but most of his time. He was off barnstorming and running afoul of AAA all the time, because they frowned on such activities. But he made a very good living and was quite a promoter.
By the way, I found every website I found that listed Dusty Farno says he passed away May 25th of 1981. So I have three or four different sources.
I'd never seen that before. That would be interesting if he was alive that late.
Racing Reference is one of them. Of course, Wikipedia, everyone's favorite, and some others. But as we know, oftentimes websites, they'll see if one source is wrong, it's going to be picked up and duplicated in multiple sources. So there you go.
I remember that there's a fellow in England that's got a really good one, but he posted that Eb Rose had passed. It was deceased. And I had gone down to the Lloyd Ruby overpass dedication, and Eb was there. And I sent this
of my
message
demise,
and said, I just thought you'd like to know I spent some time with the late Eb Rose.
Wow. Okay. That's it for tonight. We will be back, or at least Donald will, tomorrow night. My participation is questionable at this point with some youth activities and so forth for tomorrow night, but we'll have Trackside Live tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Donald will be here at 8 o'clock. Maybe David Deering will be in the saddle for that one as well. And then another email show is coming up on Thursday, so we look forward to all of that. Thank you, Donald. We'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks for joining us on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.